Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is promising to rid Turkey of people involved in Friday's failed coup attempt as authorities continue to carry out arrests of those allegedly responsible. Around 6,000 people have been detained. State-run media reports an aide to Erdogan is among those detained after the coup attempt. Erdogan said authorities will continue to pursue supporters of exiled Islamist cleric Fethullah Gulen, whom Erdogan has blamed for the coup. Gulen has been living in the United States since before Erdogan came to power. He condemned the coup and denied he had anything to do with the military revolt. During a visit Sunday to Luxembourg, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said they have not yet received an official extradition request from Turkey.
We fully anticipate that there will be questions raised about Mr. Gulen. And obviously, we invite the government of Turkey, as we always do, to present us with any legitimate evidence that withstands scrutiny. And the United States will accept that and look at it and make judgments about it appropriately.
Turkish officials have arrested judges and military officers in connection with the attempted plot. French police Sunday released the estranged wife of the truck driver who ran down nearly 300 Bastille Day revelers in the resort town of Nice, but are still questioning six others to see if the attacker was acting alone. The woman, the mother of attacker Mohamed Lahouage Bouzlel's three children, had been arrested Friday. This is VOA News. Three police officers were wounded and shot and killed, and several others were wounded Sunday in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, after at least one masked gunman described as dressed in black opened fire with an assault rifle. Early details remain sketchy, but authorities say one suspect has been killed with a fourth officer reported in critical condition at a local hospital. Police have launched a massive manhunt for other suspects. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards called it an unspeakable and unjustified attack on all of us at a time when we need unity and healing. The White House says President Barack Obama has been briefed and says U.S. resources have been made available to local authorities. Baton Rouge was the scene of a fatal police shooting of a black man on July 5th that sparked widespread protests in major cities across the country. The shooting death of Alton Sterling was recorded on a cell phone and widely circulated on social media. Pakistani policymakers and legislators stand puzzled over the way the United States has lately conducted its relationship with Islamabad and the extremely opposing views emanating from the U.S. Congress about Pakistani counterterrorism efforts. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Pakistan and the United States have long had uneasy relations. Ties have been strained recently over allegations that Pakistan's counter-terrorism operations focus only on militants linked to the anti-state Pakistani Taliban, while sanctuaries linked to Afghan militants, including the Haqqani Network terrorist group, remain untouched. Last week, in a congressional subcommittee hearing, former U.S. Ambassador to Kabul Zalmay Khalilzad cited Islamabad's continued covert support for Taliban and Haqqani fighters as the primary source of the Afghan war. But Pakistani officials and politicians dismissed the allegations as baseless concerns. The partnership and cooperation to fight terrorism continues, and both countries acknowledge it. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Scores of demonstrators in Vietnam's capital who gathered to support an international tribunal's rejection of China's claims in the South China Sea were hustled away by police before their rally started. The protesters were meeting Sunday at the landmark Hoan Kiem Lake, a common spot for demonstrations in Hanoi, when police forces descended on them. Vietnam has a history of clamping down on protests, fearful the rallies could stir dissent. The Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration recently ruled against China in a case filed by the Philippines about China's historical claim to about 90% of the South China Sea, one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I think the thing to watch for is who the government goes after in trying to pursue the leaders or those involved in this failed coup.
Turkey arrests thousands of people in the aftermath of a failed coup.
The European Union provides over 70% of the ICC's budget, something which also violates the Rome Statute, which says that no one member state can pay more than 22%.
A key African Union advisory body condemns the International Criminal Court.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana has been preparing feverishly to have the election conducted on the 7th of November. And as we speak, all our activities are geared towards having the election on the 7th of November.
And the Electoral Commission of Ghana dismisses reports that it's not ready to organize this year's polls. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Turkey, the government has arrested thousands of people in the aftermath of a failed coup that began Friday. Turkish officials say over 2,800 soldiers and officers who staged the coup have been arrested as the president accused an exiled cleric, Fethullah Gulen, of organizing the plot. He denies the charge. Laura Patel is a freelance journalist based in Istanbul. She spoke with viewers William Eagle about the failed coup and about the atmosphere on the streets of Istanbul.
The streets of pretty quiet, and everywhere you went, people were kind of stopping, either watching TVs and reading the news on their mobile phone. In some places, there were tanks in the street in perfectly normal areas that had been abandoned by the plotters. So people were stopping to take pictures, to marvel at this bizarre sight. Turkey's a country that's had quite a lot of goings on over the last 12 months. There's been a series of suicide bombings. And so it's kind of got used to things happening, but this was something else. People couldn't believe it. You know, not since 1980 has there been a serious armed takeover of power in this way.
According to the broadcasts by the government and speculation by analysts, what should we be looking for over the next few days? What are the immediate steps that are likely to be taken by the government?
I think the thing to watch for is who the government goes after in trying to pursue the leaders or those involved in this failed coup. We heard today, this afternoon, that 2,700 judges have lost their jobs. They've been sacked from their roles, and also some more senior prosecutors as well. And this is already ringing alarm bells amongst the critics of President Erdogan, because what they fear is that he will use this coup as a way of bolstering his very fiercely held ambition to become an executive president in Turkey. The role in the past has been ceremonial, and he wants to change it to officially give himself more powers. And the fear is that he will use this as cover for going after opponents, to eroding checks and balances. So that's definitely something to watch.
What are people saying about the geopolitical position of Turkey? There is some concern here that a weakened Turkey, of course, is bad for the NATO alliance and also could have an effect on the refugee situation. Turkey has an agreement with Europe to take back some of the refugees trying to get to Europe.
Right, exactly. I think governments in the West and in Europe certainly don't always see eye to eye with President Erdogan, who's a controversial figure. But Turkey will always be an incredibly important ally for them, mainly just because of its strategic position. It sits in between Europe and the Middle East. So to the west, it borders Greece and Bulgaria and, you know, beyond the countries like Germany, if you carry on going. But to the east and the south, it borders Syria and Iraq and Iran. And obviously, two of those countries are in incredible turmoil at the moment. Turkey has played a key role in stemming the flow of refugees to Europe after striking this deal. Turkey also allows one of its air bases in the south, Incirlik, to be used by the United States and to launch airstrikes against Islamic State. And the sense that Turkey, which was once this kind of buffer zone between the tumultuous Middle East and more stable Europe, it's kind of slipping away now because we've had a huge number of suicide bombings over the last year. And now we've had a full-blown, albeit a failed coup. I think these are very dark and worrying times for Turkey.
Also, some people say that there could be a bit of tension with the U.S. over one of Erdogan's rivals, who he blames for this coup, that lives in Pennsylvania. Tell us more about
that. Yeah, that's definitely one to watch. So there's this very influential Islamic cleric called Fethi Gulen, who used to be a key ally of Erdogan. He has a lot of supporters, or he did have, in the bureaucracy, in the military, scattered throughout society. And President Erdogan allied with him and his supporters and used them in his first years in government. But they fell out spectacularly. And Erdogan blames them for what he also saw as a coup a couple of years ago when leaked tapes emerged that apparently showed him involved in kind of corrupt conversations about money. And he saw that as an attempt to overthrow his government by this former ally turned foe. And now he lives in the United States, in Pennsylvania. That's a source of great upset for Turkey. There was even a little bit of kind of uncertainty about the future of Incirlik Air Base, where the U.S. launches airstrikes on ISIS this afternoon, because it was shut down for a while. I think there will be some worry in the U.S. that perhaps Turkey could try to use that as a bargaining tool to get them to hand over Fethullah Gulen or launch investigations against him. Secretary of State John Kerry has said today that he is happy to work with Turkey to investigate the origins of this coup, but there's a slight dig in there, and that he said that he wanted to see legitimate, credible evidence against this guy in order to make that happen.
Laura Patel is a freelance journalist in Istanbul. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. A key advisory body of the African Union has condemned the International Criminal Court. While the Economic, Social and Cultural Council does not speak for the AU, its statement echoed the complaints of some African leaders. For VOA, Nick Long reports from the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
Last April, the African Union mandated a committee led by the Ethiopian Foreign Minister to come up with a joint position on the International Criminal Court, or ICC. That committee is understood to have recommended that AU member states quit the ICC unless it meets three conditions, including giving heads of state immunity from prosecution. That message was relayed here by the Economic, Social and Cultural Council, or ECOSOC, an AU advisory organ that was chosen by civil society organisations across the continent. Ahead of the AU summit this week, ECOSOC spokesman Joseph Chilenge told journalists gathered in Kigali the ICC is not independent as it follows United Nations Security Council guidance. He argues it would never indict North Americans or Europeans.
The European Union provides over 70% of the ICC's budget, something which also violates the Rome Statute, which says that no one member state can pay more than 22% of the budget. And as we know, he who pays the piper holds the tune.
Chilenge brushed aside a journalist's point that the EU is not a state, saying that it behaves like one. The ICC is funded by member states using a formula similar to the one used to fund the United Nations, which means wealthier states pay more. Many people in Africa, including some African leaders, have argued that the ICC is biased against Africa, as thus far it has focused on Africa. Of its 10 active investigations, only one is outside Africa. Kenya's government is among several on the continent that has considered leaving the ICC. Chilenge warned against a proposed amendment to the Rome Statute that set up the ICC, one that would affect the UN peacekeeping forces known as the Blue Berets.
The danger is this. If there is an amendment to the Rome Statute that the Blue Berets begin to arrest our leaders, then the Blue Berets will also not be allowed in member states.
Human Rights Watch commented that to give heads of state that are signatories of the Rome Statute exemption from prosecution at the ICC would run totally counter to the statute. Human Rights Watch spokeswoman Elise Kepler told VOA that Nigeria, Senegal and Ivory Coast oppose moves at this summit to promote the AU's withdrawal from the ICC and raised objections at the discussions this week in the Executive Council meetings. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
A senior advisor to the Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has denied reports that the administration has launched a witch hunt against opposition leader Moise Katumbi. Katumbi is in the United States, where he has been reportedly meeting senior officials in Washington. But presidential advisor Bernabe Kikaya bin Karubi told me the government in Kinshasa doesn't have a problem with opposition leaders' meetings in Washington and elsewhere.
Moise Katumbi is an individual, is a Congolese citizen, is free to go wherever he wants and meet with whomever he wants. The only problem that we may have with him is that he left the Congo for medical reasons. He has a legal case in process in Congo. He still has to answer questions on legal matters, and he was asked not to say anything about the case while traveling abroad. So he can meet with people, he can talk to people, as long as he doesn't address the case which is pending with the Congolese judicial system, there is no problem with us.
A lot of critics of your government are saying that he is being witch-hunted because he seeks to challenge or participate in the election to replace President Kabila. If the elections are held this year, and that is why the government is going after him. Your response to such criticisms?
No, the government is not going after him. He has a problem with justice. He has to face the justice system. When you commit a crime in any country, you have to face the music in front of the judges. The fact of being a politician, the fact of being a presidential candidate, does not exonerate you from facing the justice if you commit a crime. And that's what happened to him. It has absolutely nothing to do with the government. There is a criminal case against Mr. Katumbi, and what the justice system, the judges, want is to see him go back home and then go and answer questions on this case which is pending.
Well, the U.S. Congress has passed a resolution, I'm sure you are aware of it, basically displeased with the political situation in the country. Most people, they said, in Congo are not sure whether President Kabila will allow elections to be held or not. Now, the question is, will democratic elections be held this year in Congo, as people say, probably in November?
Well, even the United Nations mission in the Congo came up with a statement yesterday saying that because of technical problems, it will be almost impossible to organize elections in the Congo this year. There are technical problems, as it may occur in any country. As a matter of fact, in our own country, we had to face the same kind of problem in 2005 when we were supposed to organize elections. But because of technical questions, the elections were postponed until 2006. And today we are facing exactly the same thing. And everybody, all international organizations, even particular countries, have recognized that the challenges that the Congo faces in order to organize the upcoming elections will not allow the Congolese to have those elections this year. So now it's a question of knowing when will the elections occur. And the technical people are telling us we need maybe a year, maybe a year and a half, but elections are in motion already. The registration for a new voter roll is underway. So elections will take place. What we in the Congo want is peaceful, transparent, quiet elections that nobody is going to contest.
The critics are saying that the constitution stipulates the time the president and the government is supposed to be in power. And now that the time seems to be elapsing, they want a transitional government so there wouldn't be an overlap and the constitution would be respected. Otherwise, then they would accuse President Kabila of undermining the same constitution he swore to protect.
It's very unfair. First of all, the transition is nowhere to be seen in our constitution. The constitution says clearly that President Kabila stays in power until a new president is elected. So the key thing here is for us as Congolese, all political leaders, to sit around the table and talk about when are we going to have a clean election in order to decide the next step forward. So accusations back and forth will not help anybody. We just have to recognize the fact that we have technical problems. Let's solve those. Let's find financing. Let's have secure, peaceful, transparent elections so that we can have a peaceful transfer of power for once in the Congo.
Bernabe Kikaya Bin Karubi is DRC President Kabila's chief diplomatic advisor. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The Electoral Commission of Ghana has dismissed local media reports that it is not fully prepared to organize the anticipated November 7 elections. This as Parliament discusses an electoral amendment bill that would change the regular election date from December 7 to November 7. In their recent deliberation, some parliamentarians expressed concern that the Electoral Commission might not be ready to administer the polls. But E. Eric Japasu, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, told me the electoral body is implementing measures to ensure it is prepared to organize the elections.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana has been preparing feverishly to have the election conducted on the 7th of November. And as we speak, all our activities are geared towards having the elections on the 7th of November. So if Parliament passes the bill, we are very confident that we'll be able to conduct the election on the 7th of November.
Does that mean that the Electoral Commission will go on a media campaign to educate Ghanaians about the preparedness of the Electoral Commission following reports in the local media that the Electoral Commission might not necessarily be ready?
As we speak now, this concern has been raised for some time now, and we have consistently responded to the media and to the public that we as a commission, we are preparing for the elections on the 7th of November. We have submitted the amendment bill, and we have done whatever needs to be done by the commission. All that is left is for the parliament to pass it through. But if parliament decides not to pass it through, we are still comfortable with it. We have consistently explained to the media, to all those who care to ask, that yes, we are ready for 7th of November.
The Electoral Commission recently came up with a statement that some people have to be deleted in the voter register who use the NHIS as their identification card. The Electoral Commission said it has gone ahead to do it. What is the window that the Electoral Commission will have for these people to register before the elections?
We have deleted the names. We met the stakeholders at our usual monthly IPAC meeting just about Tuesday ago, and we indicated to them that we have deleted the names, and we rolled out the roadmap for the re-registration and exhibition of the register of those whose names have been deleted. So what we said is that from the 18th of July to the 28th of July, all persons who are affected by the deletion will have the opportunity to register at the various district offices of the Electoral Commission. Then from the 5th or 7th of August, the register will be exhibited, and together with the provisional register we have now, will be certified for the election if it is approved on the 7th of November.
Some political parties have questioned the credibility of the Electoral Commission. And your commission chairperson recently has said that a discredited Electoral Commission could spell disaster for the country. What is the cooperation between the Electoral Commission and these stakeholders, including the participating political parties, to resolve their concerns before the election?
The political parties and the stakeholders were at the IPAC meeting on Tuesday. We rolled out all these programs, and we had a unanimous approval. None of the political parties rejected any of the programs that we submitted. They even wanted a timetable for our election, should it come on the 7th of November. And as we speak, we have even submitted soft copies to them. So the relationship, if what went on at the IPAC is anything to go back, and of course, it's something to go by, it's very cordial and very understanding. We met, we gave them the roadmap, we gave them the modalities, and they did not raise any objection to any of such modalities and plans that we gave them at the IPAC just Tuesday.
What would you tell Ghanaians for them to repose confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission to administer free, fair, credible, and transparent elections that will meet international standards come this year's vote?
We have consistently explained to them. We have told them that our activities, our procedures are time-bound. They are regulated by the electoral laws, and every activity is scheduled to take place at a particular point in time. And as we speak, next week we'll finish the exhibition. If Parliament approves of the 7th of November, we'll roll out the entire program for the election. If they decide to send it to the 7th of December, we'll just amend the timetable that we have for the November 7th election to fit in with that of 7th of December. In fact, we have consistently on the media, on our website and our Facebook pages, explained to the Ghanaian public that we are focused, and if Parliament approves of the election, as usual, we shall conduct a free, fair, and credible election on the 7th of November.
Eric Jakpasu is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Amnesty International has called for an immediate investigation of police beatings of opposition supporters in Uganda. This as Opposition Forum for Democratic supporters lined the roads to cheer Kizza Besigye, who was the party's presidential candidate in the February elections after he was granted bail in his ongoing treason trial. Abdoulaye Boru Halaki is the East Africa researcher at Amnesty International. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in the Kenyan capital Nairobi for his reaction to the Ugandan police brutality.
What we are seeing in Uganda right now is an escalation of what has been all too familiar for the past few years as far as opposition and activism is concerned, where opposition to the administration is largely criminalized. The latest being, you know, these people just gone to receive their leader were beaten for no clear reasons. As if that is not enough, the police leadership tried to justify, saying that in a very cynical way, saying that, you know, caning people doesn't kill them. You know, you guys complain when we use tear gas, live ammunition. But, you know, that is a very, very low standard. If your standard is people are not killed, then we are beginning to have a really serious, serious problem.
What's your take on the police chief who was speaking on behalf of government, justifying the brutality of the force?
I think that is a very, very serious problem. General Kale Kaihura, since taking the helm of police leadership, has consistently demonstrated that, you know, the rule of law doesn't apply to him or, you know, people under his leadership. It's the right time for him to begin sticking to the work of the police. The work of the police is to protect lives and properties of people. It is not to punish people. What we are consistently seeing across the board is punitive policing, where the police and leadership go out of their way and punish people for merely doing nothing, for merely exercising their freedom of expression, association, and assembly.
Are you concerned that the Ugandan government has made it a habit of harassing members of the opposition, including their leaders, beating them up, arresting them arbitrarily, and in some cases even killing them?
We are very concerned, and we have consistently spoken out about, you know, the conduct of the Uganda police and also the military before, during, and after the elections. We are extremely worried with what is going on in Uganda, and we've made our stand very clear. The violations that are taking place right now and the violations that took place before and during the elections are not, you know, consistent with Ugandan laws and the international laws that Uganda has ratified. You cannot beat people because they are standing in a line just to receive someone. What crime did these people commit? Supporting Dr. Kizza Besigye is not a crime in and of itself. Going out and receiving him is not a crime anywhere. So the idea that somehow you can just beat people who are standing, waiting and cheering, using sticks, is absolutely unacceptable in 2016 in anywhere in the world.
Abdoulaye Boru Halaki, the East Africa researcher at Amnesty International. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi, Kenya.
Political conventions are a critical part of the American electoral process. Our job is to put the conventions, the candidates, and the issues into context for our listeners. Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic Party's conventions starting July 18th on VOA.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, ZESCO United of Zambia boosted their hopes of progressing in the African Champions League with a 3-1 victory over ASEC Mimosa of Ivory Coast as Egyptian giants Al Ahly saw their own challenge a falter. ZESCO moved up above ASEC to second in Group A, a point behind leaders Wydad Casablanca, who drew 0-0 at bottom side Al Ahly on Saturday night. Only the group winners and runners-up qualify for the semi-finals, which leaves Al Ahly with little hope of advancing. Ahly, pre-season favourites for a record-extending ninth title, have already fallen to a 3-2 away defeat to ZESCO United and a 2-1 loss at home to ASEC Mimosa. The goalless draw in Alexandria strengthens Wydad's position at the top of Group A and on course to qualify for the last four. Earlier on Saturday, ZESCO United faced a formidable ASEC Mimosa team who had excelled in away matches this year, winning 3 out of 4 before the clash in Indola. But the hosts, who have now won 5 CAF matches at home this season, dominated the Ivorians from the start, going into the break 2-0 up thanks to goals from Jackson Mwanza and John Chingandu. Zamalek of Egypt hosts Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa on Sunday in the lone Group B fixture, with Enyimba of Nigeria receiving a bye after Entente Setif of Algeria were booted out over crowd trouble. The Cairo White Knights are the only unbeaten side in the competition and favored to win despite tiredness as the fixture-saturated domestic season draws to a close. In the African Confederation Cup, the defending champions, Etoile du Sahel, secured their first victory of the group phase with an emphatic 2-0 win over Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya on Saturday night to remain title contenders. The result means they are now 3 points off Group B leaders FUS Rabat and 2 points behind the other Moroccan side, second-placed Kawakab Marrakech. Following FUS Rabat's 3-1 win away to fellow Moroccan Kawakab Marrakech on Friday night, which put FUS top of the table, Etoile remains in the hunt for a place in the last four. Until Friday, Kawakab Marrakech had won all 5 of their CAF home matches this year, and a defeat to their Moroccan rivals relegated them to second in Group B. On Sunday, there is one Group A match, with favourites TP Mazembe expecting a serious challenge from Mamelodi Berger. Both teams are unbeaten in Group A, with DR Congo's TP Mazembe leading the Algerian opponents by 2 points after 2 games. Title holders Mazembe were eliminated from the Champions League in the final qualifying round and demoted to the Confederation Cup, a fate that also befell the opponents. In the other Group A match, Tanzania's young Africans were held to a 1-1 draw by Ghanaian side Madiema on Saturday, a result which did little for either side's hopes of progressing out of the group. Madiema are 2 points behind Bajia ahead of Sunday's game against group leaders TP Mazembe. Young Africans are still bottom of Group A with 1 point. And in athletics, the Ethiopian Athletics Federation has announced their final team for Rio 2016. Almaz Ayan will seek to become just the second woman in history to win Olympic gold in both the 5,000 meters and the 10,000 meters at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games next month. The 24-year-old was announced for both events by the Ethiopian Athletics Federation and appears to hold a strong chance of emulating the feat first accomplished by countrywoman Tirunesha Dibaba in 2008. Ayan tops the world lists at both distances this year. Reigning Olympic 10,000 meters champion Tirunesha Dibaba is slated to compete solely over that distance in Rio, though is also listed as a reserve for the 5,000 meters. Kanzebe Dibaba will narrow her focus and compete over 1,500 meters, the event at which she holds the world record at 3:50.07. Gabriel Meskel, the silver medalist over 5,000 meters at the London 2012 Olympic Games, will bid to go one better over the same distance in Rio and will be joined by Mokhtar Edris and Hagos Gabrihiwet. The men's marathon team is headed by Tesfaye Abera, a winner in both Dubai and Hamburg this year. Lemi Bahanu, a runner-up in Dubai this year, will join him on the team along with Fayesi Lelisa, a winner at the Tokyo Marathon earlier this year. The women's marathon trio is headed by world champion Mary Dibaba, who will be joined by 2015 London Marathon champion Tigist Tufa and 2016 Dubai Marathon winner Tiffy Segaye. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
If no be God, who are for me? I'll be a nobody, nobody. But for God, who are me? I'm a somebody. So I give it all to you. I'm nothing on my own. I have nothing of my own. I have no power of my own. I have no power of my own. Cause you're my greatest superstar. Now you give me the cow. So that everywhere I go, hey, oh, now you got it. I'll be a nobody, nobody.
God, who are me? I'm a somebody. Jehovah, I'm my superstar.
Hola, hola, ahí el limón. Hola, hola, must go. Olu was in the ghetto boy, no. Boy and me, cash to them, Rastamamba for them. Tell them say run for them, sugar boy, give them the run. And you know and we live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. We live for the party, no innocent nobody. I say we live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. Not kill myself, nothing. Lady, tonight, are you sure you can take this love? DJ jam this song, all my people sing along. We live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. We live for the party, no innocent, no. I say we live for the party, oh Lord have mercy. Hola, hola, with fucking bars.
Ori lo jawo, nobody saw lamba. And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. On the 40th anniversary of the Israeli risky but spectacular hostage rescue operation in Entebbe, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel paid visits to Africa in furtherance of good relationship between Israel and African states. This relationship has been a checkered one, and there is an erroneous belief that the African states are hostile to Israel. The fact of the matter is that when many African states gained their independence in the 1960s, almost all of them in sub-Saharan Africa established cordial relations with Israel. Israel, in turn, provided technical assistance in areas like agriculture. The problem began after the Six-Day War in 1967. At that time, Israel occupied large swathes of Arab and Egyptian territory. But the Africans were more concerned with Israel's occupation of an African country in Sinai. But still, the Africans maintained good relationship. And when in 1971, Israel rejected the Yarin Memorandum, which had called for an Israeli pledge to withdraw from occupied territories, the then OAU sent two specific missions to Israel when Prime Minister Meir was in charge. It was a very shaky mission because Israel maintained its position that it could not return to the June 6th line of 1967. The major break with Israel occurred in 1973, and the initiative was taken by a very good friend of Israel, President Mobutu, of then Zaire. At the wake of the Yom Kippur War, almost all of the African states broke relations with Israel. But they did this not because they were hostile to Israel, but for some specific reasons. One, many African states strongly believe in self-determination because their own independence was based on that principle. Therefore, they believe firmly that the Palestinian people should enjoy self-determination, and that explains their strong support for the Palestinian cause. Secondly, the African states are totally opposed to the concept of occupation, and so long as Israel was occupying Arab lands, African states in the General Assembly were opposing Israeli policy. Not because there is any kind of anti-Semitism. Now Israel is trying to improve its relations with African states, and there are many African states that are willing to do so. But it will be an illusion to believe that one can establish firm and cordial relations with African states if Israel continues to occupy territories in Palestine and fail to accept a two-state policy. African states will accept two-state policy and with Israel in secure and recognized boundaries. Secondly, African states want Israel to withdraw from occupied territories, and therefore they are not in favor, like many other countries in the international community, of Israel's settlement policy. So this is the challenge for the Israeli government. Yes, cordial relations, but Africans want the Palestinians to have their own states. They want Israel to withdraw from occupied territories to secure and recognize boundaries. When that is done, the relationship between Israel and the majority of African states will flourish, and they will resume the kinds of technical assistance that Israel was known for in the 60s. But even now, Israel has very good relations with some African states, particularly Rwanda. So this is what we should expect if the visit of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu could be fruitful. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a cockroach knows how to sing and dance, but it is the hen who prevents it from performing its art during the day. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 9th, the fifth anniversary of South Sudan's independence passed without celebration. Instead, the capital city, Juba, was consumed with renewed fighting between rival factions, which escalated into violence reminiscent of the country's civil war and raised fears for the country's increasingly fragile peace. In December 2013, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar escalated into a civil war. Fighting reopened ethnic fault lines between Kiir's Dinka and Machar's Nuer ethnic groups. Some reports indicate up to 50,000 people have been killed and more than 2.2 million driven from their homes, with many fleeing to neighboring states. Finally, last August, both Salva Kiir and Riek Machar signed a peace agreement to end the devastating conflict. The agreement confirmed Salva Kiir as president and Riek Machar returned to government as the first vice president. The agreement provided for a transitional government of national unity. In late April, Riek Machar arrived in Juba and was sworn in as first vice president. It seemed South Sudan was finally turning a corner. The sudden eruption of violence in recent days, in addition to the tragedy of more lives lost and more people displaced, has cast a deep shadow over the prospects for lasting peace under the agreement. The United States and the rest of the world have called for all sides to abide by the ceasefire declared on July 11th and allow the security situation to stabilize. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said, "Yet again, the leaders of South Sudan have failed their people. Rarely has a country's conduct squandered so much promise so quickly." The United Nations Security Council, the African Union, and regional partners have been actively engaged in calling on the leaders in South Sudan to commit to the full and immediate implementation of the peace agreement, including the permanent ceasefire, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby. The United States strongly urges that the two leaders do everything in their power to ensure these decrees will be fully respected and unfettered humanitarian assistance will be provided to those affected by the violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.